This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
War Stories, Episode 2, The Somme. At the beginning of 1916, the New Zealanders who had survived Gallipoli were still in Egypt. Troop numbers soared with reinforcements from New Zealand, and there were also a number of returning soldiers like Otago Law student Ted Ryburn, who had been invalided to Cairo after suffering hepatitis, and Southland farmer Will Anderson, who returned from treatment in England fully recovered from his gunshot wounds. After 2 months of training in the Egyptian desert, the newly created New Zealand Division was considered ready for the war in Europe. New rifles were issued, and they were paraded for General Sir Archibald Murray.
It is almost unbelievable to look up one way and down the other as far as one can see, and remember that every man Jack is from Pig Island.
The whole New Zealand Division was reviewed. March past bad as usual. I think we all realise that these ideal wartime conditions are at an end. The new recruits look forward to the coming events in France, but the old hands know it's an exchange from the frying pan to the fire.
The New Zealanders were shipped to France and disembarked in Marseille. From there, the men were sent north.
It's enough to say our interest in the country didn't flag for the 60 hours the train was our home. All along the line, people came out as we went by. We waved to all the girls, of course, and received blown kisses by the score. Most of the country signal boxes are worked by women. The nippers are everywhere after souvenirs in the shape of pennies, bully beef, or biscuits. The country was simply luxurious to us. We would have given quids to roll in the green grass.
The first few weeks in France involved getting acclimatised to being part of a huge army. Everyone was issued with gas masks and steel helmets and shown how to use them, and the men were advised they would be going up to the line for 8 days, spending 4 of those living in dugouts in the firing line and supports, then another 4 days in the subsidiary line. The next 8 days were spent in billets, either on farms or in the nearby towns. The network of trenches was so vast a guide was initially required to lead them up to the front line. It was also sobering to see what this place had been before the war.
Part of the sap called Plank Avenue is merely a plank wall built over a big ditch. There are fields on both sides.
We were relieved at 11 p.m. and went to our billet in the convent. The next day we went along to the baths. These were converted from an old brewery, and the big round vats made excellent baths. We shed our underclothing and picked up fresh laundered items, taking potluck as to the size. What would one of these bathhouses been worth in Gallipoli? Next in value to food itself.
During the hours of darkness, there was a lot of activity. Not only was that when trench raids took place, but it also became the time for the repair of roads and the work of supplying the forward supply dumps with items required at the front. By working at night, men were protected from daylight attacks by snipers and artillery, and it was a way of disguising where the dumps were, though the use of air observation had started to make this difficult.
After tea, I had to report with 13 men to the dump and found I was on a pushing fatigue. It is impossible to take some of the iron and stuff through miles of trenches, so a tramway along a disused road is used under cover of darkness. I suppose the distance is 3/4 of a mile to 1 mile, but we took nearly 2 hours to do it. The trucks kept coming off the line. At one corner, there is a gap of 2 or 3 inches in the lines, and every truck managed to run off there. To add to the excitement, a sniper has the corner exactly ranged, and it is not healthy to linger. Every time a flare went up, and they fire flares almost continuously all night here, we had to fling ourselves flat and freeze. All this combined to make the journey tediously long and not without a certain flavour of human interest. However, no one stopped anything all night. though while unloading at the dump in the support line, a machine gun was playing unpleasantly close overhead. We let a rip, coming back empty, and couldn't have taken more than 15 minutes. Got back about 11 and made another trip.
In the forward trenches during the day, the men had little room to move, and once repairs and alterations had been made to their part of the trench, they had nothing much to do except sleep and talk and write letters. As they'd been on the peninsula, they were plagued with lice, maggots, flies, and huge rats that lived on anything they could sink their teeth into.
They shared our rations and danced in our blankets while we slept. At the entrance to our dugout, sandbags were hung up for all the discarded litter, and an inviting hole with an inviting odour drew these rats like a magnet. The back of the unsuspecting rodent, with its head in the bag, made a good target for a trenching tool handle. Some of the officers carried revolvers and found them good targets for practice.
The positive side of gas warfare was that it did kill the rats, though the smell and poison lingered in the bottom of the trenches, and when combined with the smell of decaying body parts exhumed by exploding shells, was a sharp reminder of what was at stake.
Was up in the line chatting with some of the sergeants up their bivvy, when 7 or 8 big high explosives landed just behind us in the soft earth and mud. The sensation was astonishing. The air was forced into the back of the bivvy with such force it gave us quite a kick in the face. They are aerial torpedoes. The Hun's plan is to fire lots of these, then follow up with shrapnel. We sat and shivered under this treatment for half an hour or more, and were quite relieved when they knocked off. Decided I liked my own dugout in the back trench best.
Within a few weeks, Ted Ryburn had gained his promotion to sergeant and had some long-anticipated leave.
My first extended leave since I left New Zealand. To say the 7 days in Blighty have flown would be meaningless. They have been a dream. A chunk chipped right out of this life. Now I'm back. I can't believe I've been away.
Will Anderson had a less anticipated change of circumstance.
With 3 others, I was drafted into the newly formed stretcher squad. MacArthur, 1 of the 4, wasn't happy about it. He had not seen any fighting and declared that that was what he enlisted for. I persuaded him to give it a go. There was still plenty of time for fighting. We were to be responsible for first aid and delivering the wounded to the medical officer. We wore a red cross and a white armband, but were still rated as combatants and required to be on continuous call. Otago stretcher bearers were not required to carry a rifle or ammunition. The next day, I handed mine in.
For some time, the British had been making daring night raids on German trenches, and it wasn't long before the New Zealanders followed suit.
Our battalion had not indulged in the raids on the German trenches that had become commonplace with other units and our OC. To even things up, planned a big beauty of a raid involving a whole company, the 4th. They were out for weeks practicing for it. With a postponement or two, it began to be felt that wind of it could have reached the enemy. There was a feeling of foreboding in the air, and many saw, or imagined they saw, disaster ahead. When the day arrived, Alex Bulling and I offered to make up the required number of stretcher bearers.
Everything was left off that could identify us. Even the labels on the clothes and our identity discs. No papers of any description. Last of all, we blacked up. Grease and lamp black we used mostly. Then scouts were dished out revolvers. Most of us had big electric torches, and the bayonet men fixed one to their rifles. Bombers carried their waistcoat of bombs and had clubs if they wanted. Everyone had a few bombs in his pockets. We were at last all ready and waiting in our little parties, all as black as ink. About 11, we all filed up Plank Avenue. It was extraordinarily quiet. We were an unwieldy party, and it took far too long to get the 150 or so men out of the Sally Ports into a depression inside our wire. We went through a gap and along a bit, and through another gap in the second line of wire, and again through into the third. You have to drop down flat when a flare goes up, so it was slow work. As soon as the last wire was passed, I was startled to find the covering parties on both sides were right up against us, and the scouts were only just ahead of us. We all lay low in the grass and waited till our turn. We were the assaulting party and the last to go. We were to move right through, do our job, and then come right through, then home. After lying as thick as herrings for a couple of minutes, our slow bombardment, which had commenced when we started out, broke into an intense concentration of fire upon the section in front. What a time! We were more than 200 yards away, yet the hot blast of the continuous explosions could easily be felt. Lying on our faces, the motion was uncanny, and the deep, tearing whack of the big shells continuous.
Immediately, our guns opened up. Theirs replied, showing that the raid was expected. Instead of shelling our front line as they did before, they directed them to no man's land where we were lying exposed.
One suspicious fact was their flares were going up from both flanks directly inwards toward us. They expected us.
We all knew the sensible thing to do was to wriggle our way back to the line, but this obviously sensible thing to do did not apply here, because no one had considered it likely that our position would be shelled. No instructions were given on what to do if this happened. Until the raid was cancelled, it was still on, and there we were, securely fixed to where we lay as if pegged to the ground.
Lying on one's face out there, it was simply a case of waiting till one bit hit you harder than the rest. I got one a bit solid in the left shoulder blade and said, "Ugh!" Then after some more little bits, a sod of earth hit me in the small of the back. Pulled it off and found it had a lump of barbed wire attached from the explosion of our mortar bombs in their wire, at least 150 yards away. They must be some good, I thought. While messing around with the wire, I had my right elbow up, and all of a sudden, bang! Something smashed into my funny bone and my right arm was useless. Neither smacks hurt, and I didn't realize I was wounded. Felt as if I had yet no right to go in. My arms were nearly useless, so I crawled over to the second sergeant of our party and told him I was going back and left. When I got up, I saw what was really happening. We were getting wiped out by the shrapnel. Men were hit all round. I had to leave my rifle, and as, thank goodness, my legs were good. I ducked through the first two lots of wire all right, but didn't know the way through the next. So I cut for the stream, which I knew flowed down Plank Avenue. It was as light as day with all the flares and explosions. So I greeted the old creek like a friend and a brother and flopped down it under the wire, up to my middle in water.
Following in the rear, we came to a sizable shell hole. I had learned to make use of cover even from remote danger. In this case, it was real and imminent. The shelling went on as if it would never stop, and the mounting number of wounded to be rescued in the short summer night when the shelling stopped left me to pray that it would be possible. At one stage, I thought I heard a call. Thinking it may be the alert to make the attack, I jumped out of the shell hole but found no movement was afoot.
Got to our parapet and went along till I found the sally port. Inside the trench was deserted. Found one of our corporals and together we made our weary way down Plank Avenue to the battalion HQ and the doctor.
After it had seemed an eternity had passed, there was a break in the shelling and I got out of the shell hole again and put a wounded man nearby on the stretcher. No sooner had I done so than it resumed before. I instinctively flattened out and my patient, a few inches higher, called on me not to leave him there. I pulled him into the shell hole where we kept company until the shelling stopped again. This time for good. Lacking a helper, I said to the wounded chap if he could get on my back, I would carry him in. But he could not do that as one of his legs was out of action. I then took both arms to drag him when he said, "Not that arm." His shoulder was shot up. So by this one good arm, I dragged him along and was making good progress, and I came across an uninjured man and we soon had him back in the trench. My stretcher bearer mate, Alex, was a casualty, so I took the stretcher and with a helper set out for another victim. This I was able to repeat with the help of whoever I could get to accompany me. On one excursion I had Archie MacArthur with me. He had not been in the open under fire before this, and I impressed upon him the need to flatten out with the first bark of the machine gun. It started up and he went down, but with the palm of his hands on the ground and arms upright. Three neat little bullet holes close together through his forearm gave him the lesson. The last man I brought in was one I had told I would be back for, otherwise I might have called it a day, for daylight was appearing. I sallied out with a very good reliable companion. Crouching low, we got our man on the stretcher. Then as the parapet of the German trench showed up in the growing light, I said if we were spotted, we would need to drop the stretcher and ourselves like a stone. No sooner had we got to our feet than the guns opened up. There happened to be a sort of gouged out depression which gave us and the stretcher an advantage. But to reduce the chance of being seen, I suggested wading down this big ditch. I was glad later that we had used the ditch, for it was thought that there would be bodies in it and we could give assurance there was none.
At the dressing station, I found I was one of the first down. Although bleeding a good deal, I was very fortunate. The smack in the elbow hadn't affected the joint, and the one in the back hadn't touched the lungs. Was soon dressed and told to wait in the officer's mess. After daylight, we were packed off in motor ambulances. Rotten ride over the cobbles. Arrived at the casualty clearing station and found our first nurse. Had the black washed off my face and wounds examined. We are the first of our chaps to come through, but some of them tell me the whole company has been cut up. All the officers, all but one of the sergeants and I, suppose three quarters of the men, have been hit. Won't the Kaiser be pleased? Ugh. I'm stiff as a crutch all over from the waist up. Can't lie on left or back because of shoulder blade. Can't lie on right front or side because of elbow. I am glad to be out of it.
I went down to the dressing station with this man and took off my boot to get my wound and my heel dressed. To my surprise, although the bullet had clearly gone in and out, it had only burnt a track and not even drawn blood. As I was making my way up Plank Avenue to my dugout, I heard one man remark his companion, one of the lucky ones. My face, still blackened, revealed my identity. Of the 140 in the raid, all but 19 were killed or wounded. About the same number of dead were recovered the next day from no man's land and laid outside our dugout, where we were told not to bring them down until they were identified.
Ted Ryburn was sent on a Red Cross train to Calais, then across the Channel to a British hospital in London. As his health improved, he came to the attention of the ladies from the New Zealand Patriotic Society, who took him to a matinee at the Palladium, a concert in Regent's Park, and a boat trip up the Thames to Richmond.
Quiet day. Went out and sat in the grounds. There are about 10 or a dozen who came through the raid, so the company is well represented. The last attraction to go back is now removed because all our cobbers are here with us.
Soldiers who were not wounded were expected to carry on as normal. One way to cope was by helping the people around them.
The harvest is now in full swing, and it is a treat to join in when we have the time off. We are far enough away from the line to allow our imagination to persuade us we were back on our old pursuits.
While Will was stooking hay, his brother Rob was with the 12th Reinforcements, completing his training in England. In the early weeks of September 1916, the 1st Otago Battalion was stationed within 3 or 4 miles of Albert and within walking distance of the 2nd Otago's, to which Rob was attached. For the first time in almost 3 years, the brothers spent 2 days together before both brigades moved off. A few weeks later, Will was overcome with the feeling that Rob had been killed.
On Saturday, we went to a reserve position and the next morning went forward to supports. As we filed along a trench, we had to step over a body. The face was turned away, but I recognised it as my brother.
The German shelling was so intense, Will was unable to stop. The following day, the weather deteriorated, but the push continued.
We moved to the front of the line, which was just disconnected bits and pieces of an old German trench and shell holes. A section to an old German communication trench gave cover, but where it reached a bank they had not needed to dig, and now this exposed spot was covered by a sniper. I was warned to make a swift passage from cover to the comparative safety below. Rain at night had made this bank slippery, and at the bottom were two dead men in a big pool of porridgey water to remind one not to hesitate. Further on, there was overhead cover where one had to crawl in the mud to get through. My first trip out was to attend to Lieutenant Jones. As we had to take him in the open, we left it till dark. He was a heavy man, and the sticky mud and darkness made our passage very slow and arduous. Sometimes, we'd put the strap over our shoulders, lift up the stretcher, and find the weight of the load would not allow the feet to move. Down the stretcher would go again, get the feet cleared, and give it another go.
The ongoing offensive, the rain, and the cold put Anderson on sick parade with dysentery. He was sent back to headquarters at Freecorps, where those that were not entirely disabled by their illness were required to guard a man who had been sentenced to be shot. It was a distasteful experience for Anderson, who believed the man should have been given the opportunity of being shot by the Germans. His feelings of uselessness were compounded when he heard the mate he'd left in charge of the stretcher bearers had been killed. With no official word yet about his brother, Will found it was more difficult to sit and wait than to be active at the front.
We were all told there was a shortage of men in the line, and any that felt they were able to would be welcome there. These sort of appeals to the old hands had about as much effect as water on a duck's back. However, while I could have stayed longer, I liked the atmosphere of the place even less than nearer the line, so I said I would return.
Anderson rejoined his 1st Otago Battalion, who were holding the line near Mammoth's Wood.
Further down, a Black Watch company were having a ding-dong hand grenade duel. Starkey, our erratic, bulletproof madman, made his way along to see what the row was about. Sizing up the situation, he filled his bag with Mills bombs and told their lieutenant he would do a tidy job for them. Over he went, and running alongside the trench, he lobbed in the grenades as fast as he could handle them and pull their pins. The Black Watch officer recommended Starkey for the Victoria Cross, but while the deed might warrant its bestowal, Starkey's other deeds tipped the scales in the other direction. When under the influence of grog, he acted like a raving lunatic, and the penalty of confinement to barracks kept going up and down without pause like a sensitive barometer. One chap echoed the general opinion when he remarked to me that Starkey was not brave. He just had no feeling.
Those on the line also fought the cold and the rain, which soaked them to the skin and did not let up for days. Men drowned in the quicksand at the bottom of the shell holes, and though they erected tarps at night to keep themselves dry, sleeping on the damp, muddy ground made many ill.
On the side I lay, the cold penetrated the lung, and as it had in hospital, it congested. More than half a breath caught me like a knife. This time I did not seek the doctor's advice, but lived with it during the winter. To be sent away just to come back and adjust again to the line did not appeal to me.
This podcast was written by Brockenhurst RSA Scholarship recipient Robin Anderson. The memories of Will Anderson were taken from personal diaries and writing of William Anderson and voiced by Jack Milner. The words of Ted Ryburn were voiced by Henry Warner and based on the personal diaries of Eric Middleton Ryburn, which are located in the New Zealand National Archives and in the Imperial War Museum in London. The narration was voiced by me, Mark Aldridge. Special thanks to Roz and Di and the members of St Nicholas Parish Church, Brockenhurst, Lorraine Maguire, the Christchurch Historical Society, and the Twin City Committee from Christchurch, Dorset, for their assistance and support.